mean only that the way had been cleared, at least to Mithril Hall's lower door. Drizzt took heart when he thought of that door, of the many cunning defenses that had been rigged in that region. Even this mighty force would be hard-pressed to get through the portal. The tunnels near the lower door would pile high with bodies, drow and dwarf alike. Drizzt dared to slowly shift his head, to look past Guinevere, tight against the wall beside him, to Brunner, stuck uncomfortably between the panther's rear end and the wall. Drizzt almost managed a smile at the sight, and at the thought that he had better move quickly once the drow column passed, for Brunner would likely heave the panther right over the lip of the ledge, taking Drizzt with her. But that smile did not come to Drizzt, not in the face of his doubts. Had he done right in leading Brunner out here, he wondered, not for the first time. They could have gone back to the lower door with the dwarves they had met hours before. The king of Mithril Hall could be in place among his army. Drizzt did not underestimate how greatly Brunner's fiery presence would bolster the defense of that lower door and the defense of the Undercity. Every dwarf of Mithril Hall would sing a little louder and fight with a bit more heart in the knowledge that King Brunner Battlehammer was nearby, joining in the cause, his mighty axe leading the way. Drizzt's reasoning had kept Brunner out, and now the drow wondered if his action had been selfish. Could they even find the enemy leaders? Likely the priestesses who had led this army would be well hidden, using magic from afar, directing their forces with no more compassion than if the soldiers were pawns on a gigantic chessboard. The matron mother, or whoever was leading this force, would take no personal risks, because that was the drow way. Suddenly, up there and crouched on that ledge, Drizzt O'Erden felt very foolish. They were hunting the head, as he had explained to Brunner, but that head would not be easy to find. And given the size of the force that was marching along below them toward Mithril Hall, Drizzt and Brunner and their other companions would not likely get anywhere near the dwarven complex any time soon. The ranger put his head down and blew a deep, silent breath, composing himself, reminding himself he had taken the only possible route to winning the day. That though that lower door would not be easily breached, it would eventually come down, whether or not Brunner Battlehammer was among the defenders. But out here now, with so many drow and so many tunnels, Drizzt began to appreciate the enormity of the task before him. How could he ever hope to find the leaders of the drow army? What Drizzt did not know was that he was not the only one on a purposeful hunt.
"No word from Bregan de Earth."
Matron Beenry sat atop her drift disk, digesting the words and the meaning behind them. Quenthel started to repeat them, but a threatening scowl from her mother stopped her short. Still the phrase echoed in Matron Beenry's mind.
"No word from Bregan de Earth."
Jarlaxle was lying low, Beenry realized. For all his bravado, the mercenary leader was, in fact, a conservative one, very cautious of any risks to the band he had spent centuries putting together. Jarlaxle hadn't been overly eager to march to Mithril Hall, and had, in fact, come along only because he hadn't really been given a choice in the matter. Like Triel, Beanri's own daughter and closest advisor, the mercenary had hoped for a quick and easy conquest and a fast return to Menzo Berenzon, where so many questions were still to be answered. The fact that no word had come lately from the Bregan de Earth scouts could be coincidence, but Beanri suspected differently. Jarlaxle was lying low, and that could mean only that he, with the reports that he was constantly receiving from the sly scouts of his network, believed the momentum halted, that he, like Beenry herself, had come to the conclusion that Mithril Hall would not be easily swept away. The withered old matron mother accepted the news stoically, with confidence that Jarlaxle would be back in the fold once the tide turned again in the Dark Elves' favor. She would have to come up with a creative punishment for the mercenary leader, of course, one that would let Jarlaxle know the depth of her dismay without costing her a valuable ally. A short while later, the air in the small chamber Beenry had come to use as her throne room began to tingle with the budding energy of an enchantment. All in the room glanced nervously around and breathed easier when Methil stepped out of thin air into the midst of the drow priestesses. His expression revealed nothing, just the same passive, observant stare that always came from one of Methil's otherworldly race. Bayenri considered that always unreadable face the most frustrating facet of dealing with the Illithids. Never did they give even the subtlest clue of their true intentions.
"Yuthagen Tol Armgo is dead,"
came a thought in Bayenri's mind, a blunt report from Methil. Now it was Bayenri's turn to put on a stoic, unrevealing facade. Methil had given the disturbing thought to her and to her alone, she knew. The others, particularly Xerath and Oropol, who were becoming more and more skittish, did not need to know the news was bad. Very bad.
"The march to Mithril Hall goes well," came Methil's next telepathic message.
The Illithid shared it with all in the room, which Matron Bayenri realized by the suddenly brightening expressions.
"The tunnels are clear all the way to the lower door, where the army gathers and prepares."
Many nods and smiles came back at the Illithid, and Matron Bayenri did not have any more trouble than Methil in reading the thoughts behind those expressions. The Illithid was working hard to bolster morale, always a tentative thing in dealing with dark elves. But like Quenthel's report, or lack of report from Bregan de Earth, the first message the Illithid had given echoed in Bayenri's thoughts disconcertingly. Yuthagen Tol Armgo was dead. What might the soldiers of Barrison del Armgo, a significant force vital to the cause, do when they discovered their leader had been slain? And what of Jarlaxle, Bayenri wondered? If he had learned of the brutish weapons master's fall, that would certainly explain the silence of Bregan de Earth. Jarlaxle might be fearing the loss of the Barrison del Armgo garrison, a desertion that would shake the ranks of the army to its core.
"Jarlaxle does not know, nor do the soldiers of the Second House,"
Methil answered her telepathically, obviously reading her thoughts. Still, Bayenri managed to keep up the cheery, relatively speaking, front, seeming thrilled at the news of the army's approach to the lower door. She clearly saw a potential cancer growing within her ranks, though. A series of events that could destroy the already shaky integrity of her army and her alliances, and could cost her everything. She felt as though she were falling back to that time of ultimate chaos in Menzo Baranzon, just before the march, when Kioral seemed to have the upper hand. The destruction of House Oblodra had solidified the situation then, and Matron Bayenri felt she needed something akin to that now, some dramatic victory that would leave no doubts in the minds of the rank and file, foster loyalty with fear. She thought of House Oblodra again, and toyed with the idea of a similar display against Mithril Hall's lower door. Bayenri quickly dismissed it, realizing that what had happened in Menzo Baranzon had been a one-time event. Never before, and likely never again, and certainly not so soon afterward, had Loth come so gloriously and so fully to the material plane. On the occasion of House Oblodra's fall, Matron Bayenri had been the pure conduit of the Spider Queen's godly power. That would not happen again. Bayenri's thoughts swirled in a different direction, a more feasible trail to follow. Who killed Yuthagen Tol, she thought, knowing that Methil would hear her? The Illithid had no answer, but understood what Bayenri was implying. Bayenri knew what Yuthagen Tol had sought, knew the only prize that really mattered to the mighty weapons master. Perhaps he had found Drizdo Urden. If so, that would mean Drizdo Urden was in the lower tunnels, not behind Mithril Hall's barricades.
"You follow a dangerous course," Methil privately warned,
before Bayenri could even begin to plot out the spells that would let her find the renegade. Matron Bayenri dismissed that notion with hardly a care. She was the first matron mother of Menzo Baranzon, the conduit of Lolth, possessed of powers that could snuff the life out of any drow in the city, any matron mother, any wizard, any weapons master with hardly an effort. Bayenri's course now was indeed dangerous, she agreed. dangerous for Drizdo Erden. Most devastating was the dwarven force and the center of the blocking line, a great mass of pounding, singing warriors, mulching goblins and orcs under their heavy hammers and axes, leaping in packs atop towering minotaurs, their sheer weight of numbers bringing the brutes down. But all along the eastern end of Keeper's Dale, the press was too great from every side. Mounted knights rushed back and forth across the barbarian line, bolstering the ranks wherever the enemy seemed to be breaking through, and with their timely support the line held. Even so, Berkthgar's people found themselves inevitably pushed back. The bodies of kobolds and goblins piled high in Keeper's Dale, a score dying for every defender. But the drow could afford those losses, had expected them, and Bergignon, sitting astride his lizard, calmly watching the continuing battle from afar along with the rest of the Beanri riders, knew that the time for slaughter grew near. The defenders were growing weary, he realized. The minutes had turned into an hour, and that into two, and the assault did not diminish. Back went the defending line, and the towering eastern walls of Keeper's Dale were not so far behind them. When those walls halted the retreat, the drow wizards would strike hard. Then Bergignon would lead the charge, and Keeper's Dale would run even thicker with the blood of humans. Besnel knew they were losing, knew that a dozen dead goblins were not worth the price of an inch of ground. A resignation began to grow within the elf, tempered only by the fact that never had he seen his knights in finer form. Their tight battle groups rushed to and fro, trampling enemies, and though every man was breathing so hard he could barely sing out a war song, and every horse was lathered in thick sweat, they did not relent, did not pause. Grimly satisfied and yet terribly worried, and not just for his own men, for Elustriel had made no further appearance on the field, the elf turned his attention to Berkthgar. Then he was truly amazed. The huge Flamberga, Bankenfuere, hummed as it swept through the air, each cut obliterating any enemies foolish enough to stand close to the huge man. Blood, much of it his own, covered the barbarian from head to toe, but if Berkthgar felt any pain, he did not show it. His song and his dance were to Tempus, the god of battle, and so he sang, and so he danced, and so his enemies died. In Besnel's mind, if the drow won here and conquered Mithril Hall, one of the most tragic consequences would be that the tale of the exploits of mighty Berkthgar the Bold would not leave Keeper's Dale. A tremendous flash to the side brought the elf from his contemplations. He looked down the line to see Regveld Harpel surrounded by a dozen dead or dying flaming goblins. Regveld and Puddlejumper were also engulfed by the magical flames, dancing licks of green and red, but the wizard and his extraordinary mount did not seem bothered and continued to fight without regard for the fires. Indeed, those fires engulfing the duo became a weapon, an extension of Regveld's fury when the wizard leaped Puddlejumper nearly a dozen yards to land at the feet of two towering minotaurs. Red and green flames became white-hot and leaped out from the wizard's torso, engulfing the towering brutes. Puddlejumper hopped straight up, bringing Regveld even with the screaming minotaur's ugly faces. Out came a wand, and green blasts of energy tore into the monsters. Then Regveld was gone, leaping to the next fight, leaving the minotaurs staggering, flames consuming them. "For the good of all goodly folk," Besnel cried, holding his sword high. His battle group formed beside him, and the thunder of the charge began anew, this time barreling full stride through a mass of kobolds. They scattered the beasts and came into a thicker throng of larger enemies where the charge was stopped. Still atop their mounts, the knights in silver hacked through the morass, bright swords slaughtering enemies. Besnel was happy. He felt a satisfaction coursing through his body, a sensation of accomplishment and righteousness. The elf believed in Silvery Moon with all his heart, believed in the precept he yelled out at every opportunity. He was not sad when a goblin spear found a crease at the side of his breastplate, rushed in through his ribs, and collapsed a lung. He swayed in his saddle and somehow managed to knock the spear from his side. "For the good of all goodly folk," he said with all the strength he could muster. A goblin was beside his mount, sword coming in. Besnel winced with pain as he brought his own sword across to block. He felt weak and suddenly cold. He hardly registered the loss as his sword slipped from his hand to clang to the ground. The goblin's next strike cut solidly against the knight's thigh, the drow-made weapon tearing through Besnel's armor and drawing a line of bright blood. The goblin hooted, then went flying away, broken apart by the mighty sweep of Bonkenfuera. Berkthgar caught Besnel in his free hand as the knight slid off his mount. The barbarian felt somehow removed from the battle at that moment, as though he and the noble elf were alone in their own private place. Around them, not so far away, the knights continued the slaughter and no monsters approached. Berthgar gently lowered Besnel to the ground. The elf looked up, his golden eyes seeming hollow.
"For the good of all goodly folk," Besnel said.
His voice barely a whisper, but by the grace of Tempest, or whatever god was looking over the Battle of Keepersdale, Berkthgar heard every syllable. The barbarian nodded, and silently laid the dead elf's head on the stone. Then Berkthgar was up again, his rage multiplied, and he charged headlong into the enemy ranks, his great sword cutting a wide swath. Regveld Harpal had never known such excitement. Still in flames that did not harm him or his horse frog, but attacked any that came near, the wizard single-handedly bolstered the southern end of the defending line. He was quickly running out of spells, but Regveld didn't care, knew that he would find some way to make himself useful, some way to destroy the wretches that had come to conquer Mithril Hall. A group of minotaurs converged on him, their great spears far out in front to prevent the fires from getting at them. Regveld smiled and coaxed Puddlejumper into another flying leap, straight up between the circling monsters, higher than even minotaurs and their long spears could reach. The Harpal let out a shout of victory, then a lightning bolt silenced him. Suddenly, Regveld was free-flying, spinning in the air, and Puddlejumper was spinning the other way just below him. A second thundering bolt came in from a different angle, and a third, forking so that it hit both the wizard and his strange mount. They were each hit again, and again after that as they tumbled, falling very still upon the stone. The drow wizards had joined the battle. The invaders roared and pressed on, and even Berkthgar, outraged by the valiant elf's death, could not rally his men to hold the line. Drow lizard riders filtered in through the humanoid ranks, their long lances pushing the mounted knights inevitably back, back toward the blocking wall. Burgignon was among the first to see the next turn of the battle. He ordered a rider up the side of a rock pillar to gain a better vantage point, then turned his attention to a group nearby, pointing to the northern wall of the valley. "Go up high," the weapons master's fingers signaled to them. "Up high and around the enemy ranks, to rain death on them from above when they are pushed back against the wall." Evil smiles accompanied the agreeing nods, but a cry from the other side, from the soldier Bourguignon had sent up high, stole the moment. The rock pillar had come to life as a great elemental monster. Bourguignon and the others looked on helplessly as the stone behemoth clapped together great rock arms, splattering the drow and his lizard. There came a great clamor from behind the drow lines, from the west, and above the thunder of the Zwerfneblin charge was heard a cry of, "Bivrip!" The word Belwar Disengulp used to activate the magic in his crafted hands. It was a long time before Berkthgar and the other defenders at the eastern end of Keepersdale even understood that allies had come from the west. Those rumors eventually filtered through the tumult of battle, though, heartening defender and striking fear into invader. The goblins and dark elves engaged near that eastern wall began to look back the other way, wondering if disaster approached. Now Berkthgar did rally what remained of the non-dwarven defenders, 2/3 of his barbarians, less than 100 knights in silver, a score of long riders, and only 2 of the men from Nesme. Their ranks were depleted, but their spirit returned, and the line held again, even made progress in following the dwarven mass back out toward the middle of Keepersdale. Soon after, all semblance of order was lost in the valley. No longer did lines of soldiers define enemies. In the west, the Zwerfneblin priests battled drow wizards, and Belwar's warriors charged hard into drow ranks. They were the bitterest of enemies, ancient enemies, Drow and Svirfnebli. No less could be said on the eastern side of the valley, where dwarves and goblins hacked away at each other with abandon. It went on through the night, a wild and horrible night. Bergignon Béanry engaged in little combat, and kept the bulk of his elite lizard riders back as well, using his monstrous fodder to weary the defense. Even with the unexpected arrival of the small but powerful Svirfneblin force, the Drow soon turned the tide back their way. "We will win," the young Béanry promised those soldiers closest to him. "And what defense might be left in place beyond the western door of the dwarven complex?" Chapter 28 Divination. Quenthel Béanry sat facing a cubby of the small chamber's wall, staring down into a pool of calm water. She squinted as the pool, a scrying pool, brightened as the dawn broke on the outside world, not so far to the east of Fourth Peak. Quenthel held her breath, though she wanted to cry out in despair. Across the small chamber, Matron Béanry was similarly divining. She had used her spells to create a rough map of the area and to enchant a single tiny feather. Chanting again, Béanry tossed the feather into the air above the spread parchment and blew softly.
"Dres de Werden," she whispered in that breath,
and she puffed again as the feather flopped and flitted down to the map. A wide, evil grin spread across Béanry's face when the feather, the magical pointer, touched down, its tip indicating a group of tunnels not far away. It was true, Béanry knew then. Dres d'Urden was indeed in the tunnels outside Mithril Hall.
"We leave,"
the matron mother said suddenly, startling all in the quiet chamber. Quenthel looked back nervously over her shoulder, afraid that her mother had somehow seen what was in her scrying pool. The Béanry daughter found that she couldn't see across the room, though, for the view was blocked by a scowling Bladen Cursed, glaring down at her and past her at the approaching spectacle.
"Where are we to go?"
Xerith, near the middle of the room, asked aloud, and from her tone it was obvious she was hoping Matron Béanry's scrying had found a break in the apparent stalemate. Matron Béanry considered that tone and the sour expression on the other matron mother's face. She wasn't sure whether Xerith and Oropole, who was similarly scowling, would have preferred to hear that the way was clear into Mithril Hall or that the attack had been called off. Looking at the two of them, among the very highest-ranking commanders of the Drow army, Béanry couldn't tell whether they preferred victory or retreat. That obvious reminder of how tentative her alliance was angered Béanry. She would have liked to dismiss both of them, or better, to have them executed then and there. But Béanry could not, she realized. The morale of her army would never survive that. Besides, she wanted them, or at least one of them, to witness her glory, to see Dres d'Urden given to Loth.
"You shall go to the lower door to coordinate and strengthen the attack," Béanry said sharply to Xerith,
deciding that the two of them standing together were becoming too dangerous.
"And Oropole shall go with me."
Oropole didn't dare ask the obvious question, but Béanry saw it clearly anyway from her expression.
"We have business in the outer tunnels,"
was all Matron Béanry would offer.
"Bergignon will soon see the dawn," Quenthel's fingers motioned to her sister.
Bladen Cursed, always angry but now boiling with rage, turned away from Quenthel and the unwanted images in the scrying pool and looked back to her mother. Before she could speak, though, a telepathic intrusion came into her mind and into Quenthel's.
"Do not speak ill of other battles,"
Methil imparted to them both.
"Already Xerith and Oropole consider desertion."
Bladen Cursed considered the message and the implications and wisely held her information. The command group split apart then, with Xerith and a contingent of the elite soldiers going east toward Mithril Hall, and Matron Béanry leading Quenthel, Bladen Cursed, Methil, half a dozen skilled Béanry female warriors, and the chained Gandalug off to the south, in the direction of the spot indicated by her divining feather. On another plane, the gray mists and sludge and terrible stench of the abyss. Ertu watched the proceedings in the glassy mirror Lolth had created on the side of the mushroom opposite his throne. The great Baelor was not pleased. Matron Beenri was hunting Drizdo Urden, Ertu knew, and he knew, too, that Beenri would likely find the renegade and easily destroy him. A thousand curses erupted from the Tanari's dog-like maw, all aimed at Lolth, who had promised him freedom, freedom that only a living Drizdo Urden could bestow. To make matters even worse, a few moments later, Matron Beenri was casting yet another spell, opening a planar gate to the abyss, calling forth a mighty Glabrezu to help in her hunting. In his twisted, always suspicious mind, Ertu came to believe that this summoning was enacted only to torment him, to take one of his own kind and use the beast to facilitate the end of the pact. That was the way with Tanari, and with all the wretches of the abyss, Lolth included. These creatures were without trust for others, since they themselves could not be trusted by any but a fool. And they were an ultimately selfish lot, every one. In Ertu's eyes, every action revolved around him, because nothing else mattered, and thus, Beenri summoning a Glabrezu now was not coincidence, but a dagger jabbed by Lolth into Ertu's black heart. Ertu was the first to the opening gate. Even if he was not bound to the abyss by banishment, he could not have gone through, because Beenri, so skilled in this type of summoning, was careful to word the enchantment for a specific Tanari only. But Ertu was waiting when the Glabrezu appeared through the swirling mists, heading for the opened flaming portal. The Baelor leaped out and lashed out with his whip, catching the Glabrezu by the arm. No minor fiend, the Glabrezu moved to strike back, but stopped, seeing that Ertu did not mean to continue the attack.
"It is a deception!" Ertu roared.
The Glabrezu, its 12-foot frame hunched low, great pincers nipping anxiously at the air, paused to listen.
"I was to come forth on the material plane," Ertu went on.
"You are banished,"
the Glabrezu said matter-of-factly.
"Lolth promised an end,"
Ertu retorted, and the Glabrezu crouched lower, as if expecting the volatile fiend to leap upon him. But Ertu calmed quickly.
"An end, that I might return and bring forth behind me an army of Tanari."
Again Ertu paused. He was improvising now, but a plan was beginning to form in his wicked mind. Beenri's call came again, and it took all the Glabrezu's considerable willpower to keep it from leaping through the flaring portal.
"She will allow you only one kill," Ertu said quickly, seeing the Glabrezu's hesitance.
"One is better than none,"
the Glabrezu answered.
"Even if that one prevents my freedom on the material plane?"
Ertu asked.
"Even if it prevents me from going forth and bringing you forth as my general, that we might wreak carnage on the weakling races?"
Beenri called yet again. And this time, it was not so difficult for the Glabrezu to ignore her. Ertu held up his great hands, indicating that the Glabrezu should wait here a few moments longer. Then the Baelor sped off into the swirl to retrieve something a lesser fiend had given him not so long ago, a remnant of the time of troubles. He returned shortly with a metal coffer and gently opened it, producing a shining black sapphire. As soon as Ertu held it up, the flames of the magical portal diminished and almost went out altogether. Ertu was quick to put the thing back in its case.
"When the time is right, reveal this,"
the Baelor instructed.
"My general."
He tossed the coffer to the Glabrezu, unsure, as was the other fiend, of how this would all play out. Ertu's great shoulders ruffled in a shrug then, for there was nothing else he could do. He could prevent this fiend from going to Beenri's aid, but to what end? Beenri hardly needed a Glabrezu to deal with Drizdo Urden, a mere warrior. The call from the material plane came yet again, and this time the Glabrezu answered, stepping through the portal to join Matron Beenri's hunting party. Ertu watched in frustration as the portal closed, another gate lost to the material plane, another gate that he could not pass through. Now the Baelor had done all he could, though he had no way of knowing if it would be enough, and he had so much riding on the outcome. He went back to his mushroom throne then, to watch and wait. And hope. Brunner remembered. In the quiet ways of the tunnels, no enemies to be seen. The Eighth King of Mithril Hall paused and reflected. Likely the dawn was soon to come on the outside. Another crisp, cold day. But would it be the last day of Clan Battlehammer? Brunner looked to his four friends as they took a quick meal and a short rest. Not one of them was a dwarf, not one. And yet, Brunner Battlehammer could not name any other friends above these four. Drizzt, Catti Bree, Regis, and even Guinevar. For the first time, that truth struck the dwarf king as curious. Dwarves, though not xenophobic, usually stayed to their own kind. Witness General Dagna, who, if given his way, would kick Drizzt out of Mithril Hall and would take Talmaril away from Catti Bree to hang the bow once more in the Hall of Dumathoin. Dagna didn't trust anyone who was not a dwarf. But here they were, Brunner and his four non-dwarven companions, in perhaps the most critical and dangerous struggle of all for the defense of Mithril Hall. Surely their friendship warmed the old dwarf king's heart. But reflecting on that now did something else as well. It made Brunner think of Wulfgar, the barbarian who had been like his own son, and who would have married Catti Bree and become his son-in-law, the unlikely 7-foot prince of Mithril Hall. Brunner had never known such grief as that which bowed his strong shoulders after Wulfgar's fall. Though he should live for more than another century, Brunner had felt close to death in those 10 days of grieving, and had felt as if death would be a welcome thing. No longer. He missed Wulfgar still. Forever would his gray eyes mist up at the thought of the noble warrior. But he was the Eighth King, the leader of his proud, strong clan. Brunner's grief had passed the point of resignation and had shifted into the realm of anger. The Dark Elves were back, the same Dark Elves who had killed Wulfgar. They were the followers of Lolth, evil Lolth, and now they meant to kill Drizzt and destroy all of Mithril Hall, it seemed. Brunner had whetted his axe on drow blood many times during the night, but his rage was far from sated. Indeed, it was mounting, a slow but determined boil. Drizzt had promised they would hunt the head of their enemy, would find the leader, the priestess behind this assault. It was a promise Brunner needed to see the Drow Ranger keep. He had been quiet through much of the fighting, even in preparing for the war. Brunner was quiet now, too, letting Drizzt and the Panther lead, finding his place among the friends whenever battle was joined. In the few moments of peace and rest, Brunner saw a wary glance come his way more than once, and knew that his friends feared he was brooding again, that his heart was not in the fight. Nothing could have been farther from the truth. Those minor skirmishes didn't matter much to Brunner. He could kill 100, 1,000 drow soldiers, and his pain and anger would not relent. If he could get to the priestess behind it all, though, chop her down and decapitate the drow invading force. Brunner might know peace. The Eighth King of Mithril Hall was not brooding. He was biding his time and his energy, coming to a slow boil. He was waiting for the moment when revenge would be most sweet. Beanri's group, the giant Glabrezu in tow, had just begun moving again, the matron mother guiding them in the direction her scrying had indicated, when Methil telepathically informed her that matrons Oropol and Xerath had been continually entertaining thoughts of her demise. If Xerath couldn't find a way through Mithril Hall's lower door, she would simply organize a withdrawal. Even now, Oropol was considering the potential for swinging the whole army around and leaving Matron Beanri dead behind them, according to Methil.
"Do they plot against me?" Beanri wanted to know.
"No," Methil honestly replied. But if you are killed, they will be thrilled to turn back for Menzo Berenzon without you, that a new hierarchy might arise.
In truth, Methil's information was not unexpected. One did not have to read minds to see the discomfort and quiet rage on the faces of a matron mothers of Menzo Berenzon's fourth and fifth houses. Besides, Bayenri had suffered such hatred from her lessers, even from supposed allies such as Mes Baris Armgo, even from her own daughters for all her long life. That was an expected cost of being the first matron mother of chaotic and jealous Menzo Berenzon, a city continually at war with itself. Oropol's thoughts were to be expected, but the confirmation from the Illithid outraged the already nervous matron Bayenri. In her twisted mind, this was no ordinary war, after all. This was the will of Lolth, as Bayenri was the Spider Queen's agent. This was the pinnacle of Matron Bayenri's power, the height of Lolth-given glory. How dare Oropol and Xerath entertain such blasphemous thoughts, the first matron mother fumed. She snapped an angry glare over Oropol, who simply snorted and looked away, possibly the very worst thing she could have done. Bayenri issued telepathic orders to Methil, who in turn relayed them to the Glabrezu. The drift disks, side by side, were just following Bayenri's daughters around a bend in the tunnel, when great pincers closed around Oropol's slender waist and yanked her from her drift disk, the powerful Glabrezu easily holding her in midair.
"What is this?"
Oropol demanded, squirming to no avail.
"You wish me dead," Bayenri answered.
Quenthal and Bladen Kirst rushed back to their mother's side, and both were stunned that Bayenri had openly moved against Oropol.
"She wishes me dead," Bayenri informed her daughters. "She and Xerath believe Menzo Berenzon would be a better place without Matron Bayenri."
Oropol looked to the Illithid, obviously the one who had betrayed her. Bayenri's daughters, who had entertained similar treasonous thoughts on more than one occasion during this long, troublesome march, looked to Methil as well.
"Matron Oropol bears witness to your glory," Quenthal put in. "She will witness the death of the renegade and will know that Lolth is with us."
Oropol's features calmed at that statement, and she squirmed again, trying to loosen the Tanari's vice-like grip. Bayenri eyed her adversary dangerously, and Oropol, cocky to the end, matched the intensity of her stare. Quenthal was right, Oropol believed. Bayenri needed her to bear witness. Bringing her into line behind the war would solidify Xerath's loyalty as well, so the Drow army would be much stronger. Bayenri was a wicked old thing, but she had always been a calculating one, not ready to sacrifice an inch of power for the sake of emotional satisfaction. Witness Gandalug Battlehammer, still alive, though Bayenri certainly would have enjoyed tearing the heart from his chest many times during the long centuries of his imprisonment.
"Matron Xerath will be glad to hear of Drizzt Do'Urden's death,"
Oropol said, and lowered her eyes respectfully. The submissive gesture would suffice, she believed.
"The head of Drizzt Do'Urden will be all the proof Matron Xerath requires," Bayenri replied.
Oropol's gaze shot up, and Bayenri's daughters too looked upon their surprising mother. Bayenri ignored them all. She sent a message to Methil, who again related to the Glabrezu, and the great pincers began to squeeze around Oropol's waist.
"You cannot do this,"
Oropol objected, gasping for every word.
"Lolth is with me. You weaken your own campaign."
Quenthal wholeheartedly agreed, but kept silent, realizing the Glabrezu still had an empty pincer.
"You cannot do this," Oropol shrieked. "Xerath will—"
Her words were lost to pain.
"Drizzt Do'Urden killed you before I killed Drizzt Do'Urden," Matron Bayenri explained to Oropol. "Perfectly believable, and it makes the renegade's death all the sweeter."
Bayenri nodded to the Glabrezu, and the pincers closed, tearing through flesh and bone. Quenthal looked away, but wicked Bladen Kirst watched the spectacle with a wide smile. Oropol tried to call out once more, tried to hurl a dying curse Bayenri's way,
but her backbone snapped, and all her strength washed away. The pincers snapped shut, and Oropol Deer's body fell apart to the floor. Bladenkirst cried out in glee, thrilled by her mother's display of control and power. Quenthal, though, was outraged. Bayenri had stepped over a dangerous line. She had killed a matron mother, and had done so to the detriment of the march to Mithril Hall, purely for personal gain. Wholeheartedly devoted to Lolf, Quenthal could not abide such stupidity, and her thoughts were similar indeed to those that had gotten Oropol Deer chopped in half. Quenthal snapped a dangerous glare over Methil, realizing the Illithid was reading her thoughts. Would Methil betray her next? She narrowed her thoughts into a tight focus. "It is not Lolf's will," her mind screamed at Methil. "No longer is the Spider Queen behind my mother's actions." That notion held more implications for Methil, the Illithid emissary to Menzo Berenzon, not to Matron Bayenri, than Quenthal could guess. And her relief was great indeed when Methil did not betray her. Guinevar's ears flattened, and Drizzt, too, thought he heard a slight, distant scream. They had seen no one, enemies or friends, for several hours, and the ranger believed that any group of dark elves they now encountered would likely include the High Priestess leading the army. He motioned for the others to move with all caution, and the small band crept along, Guinevar leading the way. Drizzt fell into his underdark instincts now. He was the hunter again, the survivor who had lived alone for a decade in the wilds of the Underdark. He looked back at Brunner, Regis, and Catti Bree often, for though they were moving with all the stealth they could manage, they sounded like a marching army of armored soldiers to Drizzt's keen ears. That worried the drow, for he knew their enemies would be far quieter. He considered going a long way ahead with Guinevar, taking up the hunt alone. It was a passing thought. These were his friends, and no one could ever ask for finer allies. They slipped down a narrow, unremarkable tunnel and into a chamber that opened wide to the left and right, though the smooth wall directly opposite the tunnel was not far away. The ceiling here was higher than in the tunnel, but stalactites hung down in several areas, nearly to the floor in many places. Guinevar's ears flattened again, and the panther paused at the entrance. Drizzt came beside her and felt the same tingling sensation. The enemy was near, very near. That warrior instinct, beyond the normal senses, told the drow ranger the enemy was practically upon them. He signaled back to the three trailing, then he and the panther moved slowly and cautiously into the chamber, along the wall to the right. Catti Bree came to the entrance next and fell to one knee, bending back her bow. Her eyes, aided by the cat's eye circlet, which made even the darkest tunnel seem bathed in bright starlight, scanned the chamber, searching among the stalactite clusters. Brunner was soon beside her, and Regis came past her on the left. The halfling spotted a cubby a few feet along the wall. He pointed to himself, then to the cubby, and he inched off toward the spot. A green light appeared on the wall opposite the door, stealing the darkness. It spiraled out, opening a hole in the wall, and Matron Bayenri floated through, her daughters and their prisoner coming in behind her, along with the Illithid. Drizzt recognized the withered old drow and realized his worst fears, knew immediately that he and his friends were badly overmatched. He thought to go straight for Bayenri, but realized that he and Guinevar were not alone on this side of the chamber. From the corner of his wary eye, Drizzt caught some movement up among the stalactites. Catti Bree fired a silver-streaking arrow, practically point-blank. The arrow exploded into a shower of multicolored, harmless sparks, unable to penetrate the First Matron Mother's magical shields. Regis went into the cubby then, and cried out in sudden pain as a ward exploded. Electricity sparked around the halfling, sending him jerking this way and that, then dropping him to the floor, his curly brown hair standing straight on end. Guinevar sprang to the right, burying a drow soldier as she floated down from the stalactites. Drizzt again considered going straight for Bayenri, but found himself suddenly engaged as three more elite Bayenri guards rushed out of hiding to surround him. Drizzt shook his head in denial. Surprise now worked against him and his friends, not for them.
The enemy had expected them, he knew, had hunted them, even as they had hunted the enemy. And this was Matron Bayenri herself.
"Run!" Drizzt cried to his friends. "Flee this place!"
Chapter 29 King Against Queen. The long night drifted into morning, with the Dark Elves once again claiming the upper hand in the battle for Keeper's Dale. Bergignon's assessment of the futility of the defense, even with the Dwarven and Zwerfneblen reinforcements, seemed correct as the Drow ranks gradually engulfed the Zwerfnebli, then pushed the line in the east back toward the wall once more. But then it happened. After an entire night of fighting, after hours of shaping the battle, holding back the wizards, using the lizard riders at precise moments, and never fully committing them to the conflict, all the best-laid plans of the powerful Drow force fell apart. The rim of the mountains east of Keeper's Dale brightened, a silvery edge that signaled the coming dawn. For the Drow and the other monsters of the Underdark, that was no small event. One Drow wizard, intent on a lightning bolt that would defeat the nearest enemies, interrupted his spell and enacted a globe of darkness instead, aiming it at the tip of the sun as it peeked over the horizon, thinking to blot out the light. The spell went off and did nothing more than put a black dot in the air a long way off, and as the wizard squinted against the glare, wondering what he might try next, those defenders closest charged in and cut him down. Another Drow battling a dwarf had his opponent all but beaten. So intent was he on the kill that he hardly noticed the coming dawn, until the tip of the sun broke the horizon, sending a line of light, a line of agony to sensitive Drow eyes. Blinded and horrified, the Dark Elf whipped his weapons in a frenzy, but he never got close to hitting the mark. Then he felt a hot explosion across his ribs. All these Dark Elves had seen things in the normal spectrum of light before, but not so clearly. Not in such intense light, not with colors so rich and vivid. They had heard of the terrible sunshine. Bergignon had witnessed a dawn many years before, had watched it over his shoulder as he and his Drow raiding party fled back for the safe darkness of the lower tunnels. Now the weapons master and his charges did not know what to expect. Would the infernal sun burn them as it blinded them? They had been told by their elders that it would not, but had been warned they would be more vulnerable in the sunlight, that their enemies would be bolstered by the brightness. Bergignon called his forces into tight battle formations and tried to regroup. They could still win, the weapons master knew, though this latest development would cost many Drow lives. Dark Elves could fight blindly, but what Bergignon feared here was more than a loss of vision, it was a loss of heart. The rays slanting down from the mountains were beyond his and his troops' experience, and as frightening as it had been to walk under the canopy of unreachable stars, this event, this sunrise, was purely terrifying. Bergignon quickly conferred with his wizards, tried to see if there was some way they could counteract the dawn. What he learned instead distressed him as much as the infernal light. The Drow wizards in Keeper's Dale had eyes also in other places, and from those far-seeing mages came the initial whispers that Dark Elves were deserting in the lower tunnels, that those Drow who had been stopped in the tunnels near the eastern door had retreated from Mithril Hall, and had fled to the deeper passages on the eastern side of Fourth Peak. Bergignon understood that information easily enough. Those Drow were already on the trails leading back to Menzo Berenzon. Bergignon could not ignore the report's implications. Any alliance between Dark Elves was tentative, and the weapons master could only guess at how widespread the desertion might be. Despite the dawn, Bergignon believed his force would win in Keeper's Dale and would breach the western door. But suddenly, he had to wonder what they would find in Mithril Hall once they got there. Matron Bayenri and their allies? King Brunner and the renegade Drizzt and a host of dwarves ready to fight? The thought did not sit well with the worried weapons master. Thus, it was not greater numbers that won the day in Keeper's Dale. It was not the courage of Berthgar or Besnel, or the ferocity of Belwar and his gnomes, or the wisdom of Stumpet Rakingclaw. It was the dawn and the distrust among the enemy ranks, the lack of cohesion, and the very real fear that supporting forces would not arrive, for every Drow soldier, from Bourguignon to the lowest commoner, understood that their allies would think nothing of leaving them behind to be slaughtered. Bourguignon de Henry was not questioned by any of his soldiers when he gave the order to leave Keeper's Dale. The Lizard Riders, still more than 300 strong, rode out to the rough terrain of the north, their sticky-footed mounts leaving enemies and allies alike far behind. The very air of Keeper's Dale tingled from the tragedy and the excitement, but the sounds of battle died away to an eerie stillness, shattered occasionally by a cry of agony. Berkthgar the Bold stood tall and firm, with Stumpet Rakingclaw and Terrion Ducard, the new leader of the Knights in Silver, flanking him, and their victorious soldiers waiting, tensed behind them. 10 feet away, Belwar Dizengulp stood point for the depleted Zwerfneblin ranks. The most honored Borough Warden held his strong arms out before him, cradling the body of noble Firbol, one of many Zwerfnebli who had died this day, so far from, but in defense of, their home. They did not know what to make of each other, this almost 7-foot barbarian, and the gnome who was barely half his height. They could not talk to each other, and had no comprehensible signs of friendship to offer. They found their only common ground among the bodies of hated enemies and beloved friends, piled thick in Keeper's Dale. Fairy fire erupted along Drizzt's arms and legs, outlining him as a better target. He countered by dropping a globe of darkness over himself, an attempt to steal the enemy's advantage of 3-1 odds. Out snapped the ranger's scimitars, and he felt a strange urge from one, not from Twinkle, but from the other blade, the one Drizzt had found in the lair of the dragon Draco's Isingdeath, the blade that had been forged as a bane to creatures of fire. The scimitar was hungry. Drizzt had not felt an urge from it since— He parried the first attack and groaned, remembering the other time his scimitar had revealed its hunger, when he had battled the Baelor Eirtu. Drizzt knew what this meant. Beanri had brought friends. Gaddy Bree fired another arrow, straight at the withered old matron mother's laughing visage. Again the enchanted arrow merely erupted into a pretty display of useless sparks. The young woman turned to flee, as Drizzt had ordered. She grabbed her father, meaning to pull him along. Brunner wouldn't budge. He looked to Beanri and knew she was the source. He looked at Beanri and convinced himself that she had personally killed his boy. Then Brunner looked past Beanri to the old dwarf. Somehow, Brunner knew that dwarf. In his heart, the 8th king of Mithril Hall recognized the patron of his clan, though he could not consciously make the connection. "Run!" Catty Bree yelled at him, taking him temporarily from his thoughts. Brunner glanced at her, then looked behind, back down the tunnel. He heard fighting in the distance from somewhere behind them. Quenthel's spell went off then, and a wall of fire sprang up in the narrow tunnel, cutting off retreat. That didn't bother determined Brunner much, not now. He shrugged himself free of Catty Bree's hold and turned back to face Beanri. In his own mind, to face the evil dark elf who had killed his boy. He took a step forward. Beanri laughed at him. Drizzt parried and struck, then, using the cover of the darkness globe, quick-stepped to the side, too quickly for the dark elf coming in at his back to realize the shift. She bored in and struck hard, hitting the same drow that Drizzt had just wounded, finishing her. Hearing the movement, Drizzt came right back, both his blades whirling. To the female's credit, she registered the countering move in time to parry the first attack, the second, and the third, even the fourth. But Drizzt did not relent. He knew his fury was a dangerous thing. There remained one more enemy in the darkness globe, and for Drizzt to press against a single opponent so forcefully left him vulnerable to the other. But the ranger knew, too, that his friends sorely needed him, that every moment he spent engaged with these warriors gave the powerful priestesses time to destroy them all. The ranger's 5th attack, a wide arcing left, was cleanly picked off, as was the 6th, a straightforward right thrust. Drizzt pressed hard, would not relinquish the offensive. He knew, and the female knew, that her only hope would be in her lone remaining ally. A stifled scream, followed by the growl of a panther, ended that hope. Drizzt's fury increased, and the female continued to fall back, stumbling now in the darkness, suddenly afraid. And in that moment of fear, she banged her head hard against a low stalactite, an obstacle her keen drow senses should have detected. She shook off the blow and managed to straighten her posture, throwing one sword out in front to block another of the ranger's furious thrusts. She missed. Drizzt didn't, and Twinkle split the fine drow armor and dived deep into the female's lung. Drizzt yanked the blade free and spun around. His darkness globe went away abruptly, dispelled by the magic of the waiting Tanari. Brunner took another step, then broke into a run. Catty Bree screamed, thinking him dead, as a line of fire came down on him. Furious, frustrated, the young woman fired her bow again, and more harmless sparks exploded in the air. Through the tears of outrage that welled in her blue eyes, she hardly noticed that Brunner had shrugged off the stinging hit and broke into a full charge again. Bladen Kirst stopped the dwarf, enacting a spell that surrounded Brunner in a huge block of magical translucent goo. Brunner continued to move, but so slowly as to be barely perceptible, while the three drow priestesses laughed at him. Catty Bree fired again, and this time her arrow hit the block of goo, diving in several feet before stopping and hanging uselessly in place above her father's head. Catty Bree looked to Brunner, to Drizzt and the horrid 12-foot fiend that had appeared to the right, and to Regis, groaning and trying to crawl at her left. She felt the heat as fires raged in the tunnel behind her, heard the continuing battle back that way which she did not understand. They needed a break, a turn in the tide, and Catty Bree thought she saw it then, and a moment of hope came to her. Finished with the kill, Guinevere growled and crouched, ready to spring upon the Tanari. That moment of hope for Catty Bree was short-lived, for as the panther sprung out, one of the priestesses casually tossed something into the air Guinevere's way. The panther dissipated into gray mist in mid-leap and was gone, sent back to the astral plane.
"And so we die," Catty Bree whispered, for this enemy was too strong.
She dropped Talmaril to the floor and drew Kazidea. A deep breath steadied her, reminded her that she had run close to death's door for most of her adult life. She looked to her father and prepared to charge, prepared to die. A shape wavered in front of the block of goo, between Catty Bree and Brunner. And the look of determination on the young woman's face turned to one of disgust, as a gruesome, octopus-headed monster materialized on this side of the magical block, calmly walking, no, floating toward her. Catty Bree raised her sword, then stopped, overwhelmed suddenly by a psionic blast, the likes of which she had never known. Methil waded in. Bergignon's force pulled up and regrouped when they had cleared Keepersdale completely, had left the din of battle far behind, and were near the last run for the tunnels back to the Underdark. Dimensional doors opened near the Lizard Riders, and Drow Wizards, and those other Dark Elves, fortunate enough to have been near the Wizards when the spells were enacted, stepped through. Stragglers, infantry Drow, and a scattering of humanoid allies struggled to catch up. But they could not navigate the impossible terrain on this side of the mountain, and they were of no concern to the Beanri weapons master. All those who had escaped Keepersdale looked to Bergignon for guidance as the day brightened around them. "My mother was wrong," Bergignon said bluntly, an act of blasphemy in Drow society, where the word of any matron mother was loth given law. Not a Drow pointed it out, though, or raised a word of disagreement. Bergignon motioned to the east, and the force lumbered on into the rising sun, miserable and defeated. "The surface is for surface dwellers," Bergignon remarked to one of his advisers when she walked her mount beside his. "I shall never return."
"What of Drizzt O'Erden?"
the female asked, for it was no secret that Matron Beanri wanted her son to slay the renegade. Bergignon laughed at her. For not once since he had witnessed Drizzt's exploits at the academy had he entertained any serious thoughts of fighting the renegade. Drizzt could see little beyond the gigantic Glabrezu, And that spectacle was enough, for the ranger knew he was not prepared for such a foe, knew that the mighty creature would likely destroy him. Even if it didn't defeat him, the Glabrezu would surely hold him up long enough for Matron Bayenri to kill them all. Drizzt felt the savage hunger of his scimitar, a blade forged to kill such beasts, but he fought off the urge to charge, knew that he had to find a way around those devilish pincers. He noted Guinevar's futile leap and disappearance, another ally lost,